From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The worst of the worst is how Donald Rumsfeld described the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. For the most part, we've been forced to take his word for it. But after a 2004 Supreme Court ruling that U.S. citizens, at least, had the right to challenge their detentions, the Pentagon set up a process whereby detainees could have their day in court. And when I say court, I mean a trailer where a military panel hears from the detainee and decides whether or not he's really an enemy combatant.
The answer to that question is almost certain to be yes in the latest round of combatant status review tribunals that started Friday. In the hot seat are 14 of the highest value terror suspects, supposedly the worst of the worst of the worst, including alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They were transferred to Gitmo last summer after spending years in the CIA's global network of secret prisons, but hopes that the tribunals would finally give us a glimpse of these men were dashed this week when the Pentagon, citing national security concerns, banned reporters from covering them. Miami Herald staff writer Carol Rosenberg has been reporting on detainee issues for 5 years. She says in the early days of the tribunals, the government took a much different tack.
They wanted us there. They went out of their way to bring in flights and sponsor trips for reporters to come in and sit at a table and watch these things. You had to sign some ground rules, and the most difficult one was if the man uttered his name in the course of the proceeding or you found out his name, you were forbidden to report it.
They want reporters there to report on proceedings, judging the fate of people whom they cannot name?
Exactly. What they were saying was, we have a process, and we are going to show this process to reporters, and they're going to tell you that people come in and can make an argument, and then we're going to make a decision. And so, see, America, you can trust what we do down here because we have a process.
When we envision this hearing, I guess it would be useless to think of something from Law and Order or even the Kane Mutiny. It's not going to look like that, is it?
It's pretty basic and crude. I've attended a number of these in the trailer inside Camp Delta, and it's detainee, a prisoner in a uniform with what they call a three-piece suit, which is shackles around his arms and waist and legs, padlocked to the floor. He's sitting on a white plastic chair, and he's facing off with three military officers, and this is his chance to tell the U.S. military why they're wrong to hold him.
He and his lawyer and his witnesses?
There are no lawyers. This is a process that was created by the military to somehow resemble a battlefield status hearing. They do allow him, under certain circumstances, to bring another detainee who will get shackled into the next plastic chair next to him to a padlock on the ground, and he can help him make his argument. But there are no lawyers.
Just wild guess here. Those hearings that you witnessed, did anyone get freed?
That's sort of the irony of the whole process. You don't know. Basically, the reporter and the detainee get led into this room. You all sit in your places. He makes his argument. You take your notes. They declare the unclassified portion of it over. You leave. He leaves. Then they open up the secret file. Then they decide whether or not he's an enemy combatant. And then they make a recommendation up to Washington. And what we know is 30-some of these 500-plus were actually found not to be enemy combatants. But I don't know whether the guy I watched tell him, that wasn't me, Colonel, you've got the wrong guy. We don't know if they decided they had the wrong guy.
You know, I can see why the Pentagon would want to bring the press in to show off their supposed transparency in dealing with these prisoners. But from the press's point of view, unable as you are to name names or to report outcomes, what is the point?
Look, if you remember, what everybody saw across 5 years was guys in masks and shackles and orange jumpsuits being led around all identical. There was no way to sort of single them out. And now here's a guy telling a story. I pulled the story I wrote from November 2004, and it was the 27, 28-year-old Yemeni guy with a little beard. And he told a story. I don't know what was in his file, but what he told was he was in a madrasa, a school in Pakistan. he got rolled up and handed over to the Americans, and that the Americans said he was Al-Qaeda because the school was a front for Al-Qaeda. And he said, basically, guys, I don't know that that was true. Show me the proof that this was an Al-Qaeda school, but I'm telling you, I'm not a member of Al-Qaeda. We don't know whether that guy actually was released as not a member of Al-Qaeda, but we did get to watch him make an argument. These proceedings gave us a window into the lives of these human beings.
I want to get back to the current tribunals taking place for the so-called high-value detainees. What do you think was behind the decision to bar reporters from these proceedings altogether?
I think that the Pentagon likes to control the narrative when it comes to Guantanamo. And they knew if you put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a white plastic chair shackled to the ground and three reporters there, he might say things that the government doesn't want the world to know. He might describe the circumstances of his capture. He might describe the circumstances of an interrogation. If a guy in that chair says, you know, Colonel, they nearly drowned me and I confessed to crimes I never committed in places where I never was, we would want to write that. Even if I've signed a ground rule in which I am told that I'm not allowed to report it, a couple of years ago, a colonel said to me, you know, we still don't have one of those men in black flashy things that can erase it from your brain.
Okay, Carol, thank you so much.
Sure, I'm always glad to talk about Guantanamo.
Carol Rosenberg covers the Guantanamo Bay detention facility for the Miami Herald.
On Thursday, House Democrats finally unveiled their plan for ending U.S. military involvement in Iraq. It sets a timetable for withdrawing troops, a timetable that would be expedited if the Iraqi government doesn't make progress of its own along the way. The plan was immediately rejected as a non-starter by the White House, just as an earlier version by Congressman John Murtha was dissed by House Republicans as a slow bleed.
Their so-called slow bleed approach,
lending support to the slow bleed doctrine,
commence a, quote, slow bleed, end quote, of funding cuts.
We cannot accept this slow bleed strategy.
The phrase has appeared hundreds of times in editorials, op-eds, and letters to the editor. Now, astute news consumers might assume it was dreamed up by Republican politicos to vilify Murtha's plan. But in fact, slow bleed appeared first not in the rhetoric of politicians, but in the lead of an article in the online journal The Politico. Top House Democrats, the story read, have decided against using congressional power to force a quick end to U.S. involvement in Iraq and instead will pursue a slow bleed strategy designed to gradually limit the administration's options. The author of the phrase in question is Politico editor John Harris, formerly of The Washington Post, and he stands ready to take the blame. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
So can you briefly give us a play-by-play of how slow bleed came into being?
Absolutely. We had a story, a good one, by our Capitol Hill Bureau Chief, John Bresnahan. It was the first to lay out in detail what Congressman Murtha was proposing to do, his effort to restrict the Bush administration's flexibility to carry out this surge, but not do so by essentially pulling money back away from troops in the field. Anyway, he turned the story into us, and as often happens, when editors see a story come in, we think, well, this is good, but the writing isn't necessarily as bright and vivid and evocative as it needs to be. Jim Vandehye, my co-editor, we sat down and crafted the lead, and as we did it, we made it tighter, shorter, and that phrase, slow bleed, creeped into it. It was clear in context, I must tell you, Brooke, that what was the slow bleed was bleeding away the Bush administration's authority. Slow bleed is contrasted with a quick kill. The problem is when our article ran, people, I think, made the psychological leap that slow bleed referred to troops in the field rather than bleeding away the Bush administration's support and its ability to carry out the war.
So when did you first notice that it was being used incorrectly?
Well, we noticed it instantly because the Republican National Committee sent out a fundraising appeal in which they stated that slow bleed was Murtha's own phrase. It said, you know, the Democrats have finally come forward with what they call their slow bleed strategy. And so in the next day's paper, we did make clear that that was not Murtha's phrase. That was our own description, and noted that the phrase was being expropriated by Republicans. Even with that, the phrase continued to echo 10 days later or so, I actually laid out precisely what happened. I did so as a way to draw back the curtain on how the news business works. People often have a sense that we have more agenda or method than we really do. Lots of these decisions get made on the fly by improvisation, and that's precisely what happened here.
But how did you feel when you saw it being used incorrectly? I mean, did you feel queasy?
If I could, Brooke, I'd take back that phrase because of the ease with which it was misused. And I would happily acknowledge that we should have been a little more careful with that phrase. I don't want to award myself a gold star, but what I do think is important for media, all media, is to open the window as much as possible into their process. When they make mistakes, admit it candidly. Explain how decisions get made. Our organization was attacked by Media Matters. That's a liberal group devoted to critiquing coverage and calling out where they see things that are biased in a conservative direction. They wrote an op-ed accusing our publication of being a house organ for Republicans. And that's emphatically not true. But we tried to respond non-defensively. We published that this week online and then actually carried out a kind of an online dialogue with our staff, with four members of our staff, in which we went through the piece line by line. Some people agreed that there were good points that the op-ed made. Other people didn't think it made any good points, but we aired that. We ventilated that. We don't speak with one voice here. We don't make pretensions to being infallible. The slow bleed controversy is a clear example of how we're not infallible. I don't think the public, Brooke, expects us to be infallible. I do think they expect us to be transparent and to own up to our judgments and occasionally misjudgments.
You know, there's this joke about editors. I wonder whether you've heard it. A reporter and an editor are going through a desert. They're really parched. They come upon a pristine pool of water. The reporter jumps right in. The editor, on the other hand, drops his trousers and begins to urinate. And the reporter says, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" And the editor says, "It's okay. It's okay. I'm making it better."
Brooke, when I first heard that joke, I was a reporter. I thought it was quite funny. Now in hearing you retell it just doesn't seem as funny to me anymore.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
John Harris is editor-in-chief of The Politico.
Coming up, the media respond to Scooter Libby's prospective incarceration and the leak that sunk the political hopes of Thomas Eagleton.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, former Vice Presidential Chief of Staff Scooter Libby was found guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice. Fresh meat for hungry media. Here's MSNBC's Keith Olbermann.
The Libby lies. Were they to insulate the vice president only? And how long will that protection last?
For many on the left, it was a verdict on the war in Iraq. And for many on the right, well, the National Review said the trial, quote, proved only one thing. A White House aide became the target of a politicized prosecution set in motion by bureaucratic infighting and political cowardice. I'm joined now by two of the reporters we've spoken with on the long road to this verdict. First, Josh Gerstein, who covered Libby's trial for the New York Sun. He says that in the wake of the trial, the moral stances of the media on both ends of the political spectrum were, quote, drenched in hypocrisy.
Well, I just see a lot of reversals on both sides. You have the conservative writers and bloggers saying it's a lie about a non-crime, which is true in a sense, except that they made exactly the opposite argument back in the President Clinton impeachment days. They thought it was terrible for the president to be lying under oath, regardless of how trivial the underlying matter was. And then on the liberal side, there was nary a mention when the whole storyline that they had about this being a conspiracy across the government to expose a CIA officer, that kind of fell apart. And it turned out that Richard Armitage, the State Department official who wasn't a big fan of the war, set this in motion. When that all fell apart, you didn't hear much from the left at all. They just sort of carried on and said, let's string up Scooter Libby.
Do you think the right wing's reaction to this whole case had anything to do with the fact that David Corn, writing in the liberal Standard Bearer, The Nation, was the first to spill ink on the fact that a crime may have been committed in the initial leak?
I think there's an element of that. When Joe Wilson started talking about this, he did go to The Nation. He also went to, I believe, The New Republic and The New York Times. So there's no question that the right viewed Ambassador Wilson as an ideologue. And there's also no question that some of the information that some of those press outlets passed on at the beginning, including The New York Times, wasn't accurate. And so they actually played a role in inflaming the story, because it was those inaccuracies that led people in the vice president's office to have such an angry reaction.
And what were those inaccuracies?
Well, I believe the first New York Times column on this subject said that Mr. Wilson had gone to Africa to investigate some forged documents relating to yellowcake uranium. It turned out he had never done that. A lot of the other reports said it was basically certain that Vice President Cheney's office ordered this trip and that they got a report on it. In fact, it wasn't the case that Cheney's office ordered the trip. So some of those mistakes in the early days, as I say, led to the sort of overly angry reaction from the vice president's office and put essentially Mr. Libby in the fix he found himself in last week.
The verdict in this case is that Scooter Libby lied. It ultimately had nothing to do whether Valerie Plame was a covert agent or whether she wasn't, or any of the particulars about whether a crime was committed in leaking her name to begin with. And yet, at least some places on the political right, that still lingered as a talking point.
I heard Robert Novak, the journalist who actually ended up outing Valerie Plame, pushing it just the other day as the verdict was coming back. You know, there's a slender sliver of truth to it. It does seem like in the end it was going to be really hard for Pat Fitzgerald, the prosecutor, to prove that a crime was committed in the leak. I do think the main talking point that's been put forward by some on the right, that there's no way she could have been covert and therefore she could never have been covered by these laws that protect people who are working for the CIA, is somewhat off the mark. She had been working, as I understand it, overseas in the 5 years before this leak took place, and that made her covered under the law. So I don't quite understand the talking point, although I do see that many conservatives wish that this investigation had been shut down earlier, and that would be one way that it could have happened.
Now, we've spoken of reaction from the left, and we've spoken of reaction from the right, but lo and behold, into the fray marches Time magazine with a cover story this week depicting a cloud literally over the vice president and the headline, "The Verdict on Cheney." What are we to make of a quintessentially mainstream publication staking out such a kind of judgmental position?
I think you have to look at the poll numbers, really. Reporters look at those numbers, magazine editors look at those numbers, and everybody knows that Dick Cheney's approval ratings are basically in the toilet, for lack of a better term. And this has become really a proxy case for the war. People who are angry about the war generally wanted to see Mr. Libby convicted. Those who believe that the war is still a correct undertaking made up most of those who were backing Mr. Libby and hoped that he would be acquitted. And I think in the fight over the pardon and other fights related to this that are going to continue to go on over the next few months, we're going to see those battle lines remain drawn.
Okay. Josh, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob.
Josh Gerstein covered the Libby trial for the New York Sun. David Korn is the Washington bureau chief for The Nation magazine. He was among the very first to raise the specter of a crime in the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA officer, and he's been covering the story ever since. David, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
It seems to me like it's the OJ case all over again. Some people heard a verdict of guilty and justice at last. Some people heard a verdict of guilty and it's a miscarriage of justice. Certainly that was the response from the political far right. Is that my imagination?
No, it's not your imagination. The verdict was guilty, and it was clear that the group of conservative partisans that I call the Libby lobby were going to blast this verdict almost either way. They had already decided that the case itself was a miscarriage of justice. They've made Scooter Libby a victim of what? The issue was lying under oath, which should not be an ideological issue.
The Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is, you know, as much of an institution of the far right as anything else in mainstream journalism, has said that the press have themselves evinced far too much enthusiasm about the verdict, that they were giddy at the idea of Scooter Libby having been convicted.
I don't know what they're smoking at the offices of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. Unlike anybody who writes for that page, I was at the courthouse for two straight months with the reporters from the New York Times and the Washington Post and two dozen, three dozen other reporters. When the verdict came down on Tuesday, the only thing people were giddy about in the press room was getting the story out and getting back to their lives. There was no celebration to suggest that there is a conspiracy of giddiness among mainstream reporters. It's what the defense actually tried to do during the trial. They tried to discredit Tim Russert, the host of Meet the Press, who often is criticized by people on the left, like Arianna Huffington, of being too easy on the administration. They tried to suggest that he had a vendetta against Scooter Libby and the administration, and that was coloring his testimony and causing him to give testimony that would put Scooter Libby into legal jeopardy. They made this suggestion, and they produced absolutely no evidence to back it up.
I just want to play you something, because I think I can locate some giddiness from the mainstream media. Mind you, this isn't the Washington Post, but it is MSNBC, Chris Matthews, speaking to presidential candidate John Edwards.
What do you make of the fact that a guy who's chief of staff to the vice president is convicted for perjury and obstruction of justice for actions committed in the line of duty? In other words, he didn't go off and rob a gas station. He's accused of breaking the law while doing his job.
Yeah, I think it says bad things, and we have to let the appeals process play itself out. That's how our judicial system works, and he's entitled to his appeal, but at the end of the day, this is very troublesome.
What do you make of the fact that Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald said there's a cloud hanging over the head of the vice president right now?
Sounds pretty giddy to me.
If the best you can come up with here now in trying to indict the mainstream media is that Chris Matthews is enthusiastic in his response to the verdict, you really are picking at crumbs.
And I'm going to give you that one. You've been covering this story for a long time, since the beginning. I wonder if you think, in the end, the most important aspect of this story is about the sleazy smear tactics at the highest levels of government, or about the way journalism is practiced inside the Beltway, where sources and journalists are extremely cozy, brokering these deals for information that can have some deleterious consequences.
Actually, I don't think that's the case. There weren't too many examples of cozying that came out at the trial. Tim Russert, it turns out, got a complaint from Scooter Libby and didn't do much about it at the time. Libby tried to turn that conversation into a cover story and was caught in a lie. What came out at the trial was that when the vice president's office wanted to fight back the criticism that they had twisted the pre-war intelligence, they had Scooter Libby leak information, very selective information, to Judy Miller. But she didn't write about it because she had fallen into disrepute within the New York Times. So the story here is not that Washington reporters in general are too cozy with administration officials. It's really how the administration tries to play the press and often succeeds, but in this instance failed.
David, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
David Korn is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Nation magazine and co-author of Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War.
Former Missouri Senator Thomas Eagleton died last Sunday. His time in the national spotlight was brief. For just 18 days in 1972, Eagleton was the candidate for vice president, chosen by George McGovern in his run against Richard Nixon. Eagleton was a dark horse contender who said he was as surprised as anyone when he got the call.
3 minutes ago, George McGovern called and he said, "Tom, I've got a favor to ask of you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "I want you to be my running mate." And I think I said something like, "I hastily accept," before he could retract it and withdraw it.
Eagleton's selection came without so much as a background check. Eager to fill in his story, the Knight Ridder newspaper chain decided it needed a comprehensive bio. Cub reporter Clark Hoyt drew the short straw, and within days, he found his lead.
An anonymous caller called the Detroit Free Press, one of our newspapers, and asked to speak to John S. Knight, who was the founding father of Knight newspapers. The operator connected the caller to John S. Knight III, his grandson, who was an editorial writing intern at the Free Press. The caller said that he knew that Senator Eagleton had suffered from depression and had been treated with electroshock therapy on more than one occasion. And this caller was sure that the Republicans would find this out and use it in some underhanded way during the political campaign, so the caller believed it should get out immediately.
What did you do with the tip?
Well, even before I learned about the tip, I went to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I asked them if I could use their library and read all of their clips on Senator Eagleton. Newspaper clips in the old-fashioned envelopes are really quite revealing things. And what I saw were, in a very vivid, active public career, there would suddenly be gaps that would be unexplained. Sometimes there might be just a small paragraph that would say Senator Eagleton has been at the Mayo Clinic for a physical exam, or Senator Eagleton has been exhausted and taking a rest, something like that. So there was already a red flag. When I got the tip, it had more credibility than it might have had otherwise.
So once the facts lined up, or at least the flags lined up, did you go to the campaign?
No. I started looking for a doctor whose name we got from the tipster. And this doctor was no longer in practice, so it was quite difficult initially to locate the person. But I did, and I, in a very nervous voice, I said, I'm Clark Hoyt from Night Newspapers in Washington, and I want to talk to you about the time in March of 1961 when Senator Eagleton was treated with electroshock therapy at Renard Hospital in St. Louis. The doctor looked at me in horror, and as she slammed the door in my face, she said, I can't talk to you about that.
And so what happened after that?
Well, Robert S. Boyd, my bureau chief, and I worked on this together, and ultimately we wound up with a two-page memo that we did take then to Senator McGovern's campaign. What we didn't know at the time was he already knew. We understand that the same tipster had called the McGovern campaign and told them the same information. What we were told is, Senator Eagleton is on his way out here. You'll have an interview with him. We're as determined as you are to get to the bottom of it. Within a day or so, we knew that we were being strung along. What they finally decided to do was to have an immediate press conference and have Senator Eagleton announce his mental health history.
On three occasions in my life, I have voluntarily gone into hospitals as a result of nervous exhaustion and fatigue. As a younger man, I must say that I drove myself too far.
And in answer to a question, he said part of his treatment was shock therapy.
That's right. Big news at that point. The campaign had sort of broken, in my view, an unwritten rule between reporters and campaigns in the sense that we had a story and they simply announced it to the world. And so in what they themselves referred to as a consolation prize, they put us in a car, Bob Boyd and I, in a car with Senator Eagleton to drive from Custer back to Rapid City, South Dakota, and the airport. Senator Eagleton was sitting in the back seat. I was next to him, asking him questions all the way to fill in the profile of him that I had originally been assigned to do. He was very gracious, answered every question, some quite uncomfortable questions. Throughout it, he chain-smoked the entire time. He was perspiring profusely, and by the end of the ride, I was soaking wet from him.
And you probably understood that that was the end of his vice presidential ambitions and possibly the end of his political career. What did you think of the consequences of your actions, or did you at all?
Yes, we thought a lot about the consequences of our actions, and Bob Boyd and I have talked about it a number of times. And we always felt that it was a story that was appropriately in the public domain. We don't know everything about Senator Eagleton's medical history. He never released any records. He never authorized his doctors to talk publicly about his case. But what we do know suggests that under great stress, or at times right after great stress, he tended to shut down. And on at least two occasions, he required hospitalization and the shock therapy. And for someone who was aspiring to be vice president of the United States, the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency, I always felt that this was relevant information about his qualifications, his fitness, if you will, for the job. I don't see how we would have done it any differently.
Given what you learned about Thomas Eagleton, were you convinced he wouldn't have been a good vice president?
You know, that's a very good question. I am convinced that he was a very good senator, and he was reelected twice after that. He could have been reelected from Missouri as many times as he wanted to be. He was a very effective senator. He was one of the leaders in the War Powers Act in the Vietnam era. in private life, afterward in St. Louis. He was a commanding figure in Missouri politics. He taught law at Washington University. He was obviously a man who had a very full and rich public career. He might have been a fine vice president, but the question really is, could he have been a good president? And I don't think we really know the answer to that, because we don't really know what the nature of his condition was, whether it was all ancient history or whether under stress it might have been repeated again. We just don't know that.
Clark, thank you very much.
Brooke, thank you for asking me.
Clark Hoyt and Robert Boyd won the 1973 Pulitzer Prize for their Eagleton reporting. Clark Hoyt is currently an editorial consultant for the McClatchy Newspaper Company.
I will not divide the Democratic Party, which already has too many divisions. Therefore, tomorrow morning, I will write to the chairman of the Democratic Party, withdrawing my candidacy.
Coming up, shining the light on Congress and who snuffed out Captain America.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. I vote, and when my congressperson does something, I kind of want to know. But it can be hard to find out if the media don't cover it. Or it used to be hard to find out. This week, it got a lot easier. A new website called opencongress.org consolidates information about every Congress member and every piece of legislation, along with news and blog coverage of them and metadata about what other visitors to the site are looking at. Open Congress was launched just in time for the upcoming Sunshine Week, an initiative launched by journalists 3 years ago to promote government transparency. One of the groups behind both Sunshine Week and OpenCongress.org is the Sunlight Foundation. Mika Sifri is their technology advisor, and he joins us now. Mika, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
First of all, I simply can't believe that Open Congress is the first opportunity to, you know, have a clearinghouse online for the activities of the Congress and, you know, your own representative. Are you really first?
Well, no. To be fair, Congress has a website called Thomas, where if you are patient and comfortable with a lot of technical lingo, you can find your way to the text of a bill, and you maybe can find your way to the tally of a vote. What Open Congress does is, first of all, make it much easier for you to search for a bill, track a vote, see your entire member's voting record. That's something that's hard to do on Thomas. See what everyone is saying about a piece of legislation, whether it's from news feeds that we bring in from Google or what bloggers are saying. So you can click on bills and you'll see the bills that are most being talked about.
I'm guessing your target is people who care about issues and who do vote, but haven't necessarily been able to dig very deeply into the process of legislation. Is that a fair assumption?
That's definitely a fair assumption. A lot of the work of Congress is hidden in plain view. They put out on paper, in many cases, reports of their campaign financing or of who's sponsoring their trips and so on. But you can't necessarily get to it unless you were willing to make a trip to Washington, D.C. And so the idea of making it easier for people to access this information online and then do things with that. For example, now to be able to get an RSS feed for a bill so that you can see when changes happen to that bill, well, that's a step into the 21st century.
So I click on a little orange button on your site that says feed.
Right. And it would enable you to get automatic updates whenever something new happens. We're hoping that eventually Congress will decide to do these things itself. But in the meantime, it's important to push forward and, you know, hopefully they'll catch up.
Of all of the utilities on the site, what do you think is your killer app, the thing that will be most valuable to people like me?
Well, the thing that I find most interesting is that you can get a glimpse here of which members of Congress are generating heat and discussion in the blogosphere for whatever reason. And I think that that cumulative effect is citizens are now perched over the shoulder, breathing down the necks of members of Congress. Hopefully they'll be a little more attentive and responsive in return. And the site makes that visible.
Politicians from both parties have long paid lip service to the notion of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And yet a lot of the workings of Congress are really shrouded behind the arcana of the way legislation is made, which is not necessarily a situation that politicians dislike.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Congress people themselves think about this site?
We are in a dialogue with staffers on the Hill in trying to explore all the ways that the House could do a better job of sharing information with the public using new technology. And I think that there's a willingness, there's an awareness. I think the real question is whether members of Congress are prepared to be open with the public about the dirty business, the stuff that they do in terms of meeting with lobbyists, special favors they do for special interests. We are pushing them, for example, to tell us what they do all day at the end of the day. Post your official work calendar online so we can see who you're meeting with. So far, three members of Congress are actually doing this. We've heard from some lobbyists who think this is a great idea because they can see who's lobbying who. And then other lobbyists think this is a terrible idea because they don't want their work to be revealed to the public.
You are involved in this project as technology advisor to the Sunlight Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other internet projects underway to make legislators more accountable to the people they represent?
Oh, there are a lot of exciting things going on now. And the Sunlight Foundation is involved in a number of them. One is called MetaVid, which is really a cutting-edge effort to make it easy not just to take video clips of members of Congress speaking, but then do things with them, blog about them, add comments to them, and so on. And another project is to take the work of the Congressional Research Service. This is called the OpenCRS Project. This is a $100 million a year research agency that does all kinds of fantastic reports for members of Congress. And we, the people, pay for those reports. We might as well also have access to them, too.
Okay, Mika. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mika Sifri is technology advisor to the Sunlight Foundation and co-founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, a group working with new technology and politics.
And now for a few of your letters. We received a strong response to a pair of interviews we did pondering the question, are the big wireless carriers crippling features we could have on our cell phones? For instance, why can't we change carriers without changing phones? Elian Pohl wrote in with this observation, quote, as an American living in Denmark, I'm amazed that Americans aren't more vocal about the poor functionality of their mobile phones. The only reason I can think of is that most Americans are totally unaware of the functionality that is available to the rest of the world. During my visits to the States over the last few years, I've enjoyed going to phone stores and marveling at the primitive phones sold in the U.S. It's like visiting a mobile phone museum.
But Nathan Harms wrote in from Edmonton, Canada, to say that we were, quote, a bit unfair to Apple regarding the new iPhone. Your show made it sound as though Apple was somehow complicit in the failure of carriers to provide desired services. Actually, from what I heard, the iPhone provides a number of features unavailable on other phones, and these features were negotiated by Apple. From what I heard, part of the deal with Singular was that Apple would commit itself to Singular only in return for the concessions Singular was making.
Finally, this from Tina Wong of Somerville, Massachusetts. She writes, quote, as a result of your story on the locking of mobile phones to carriers, I sent letters to my congressman, the Better Business Bureau, and the FCC. The FCC sent me an email that states, quote, the Library of Congress ruled that mobile phone subscribers can remove software locks that prevent them from using handsets when they switch carriers. When we called Tina on her cell phone, she said she wanted to switch her service to a carrier called Working Assets because it supports liberal causes.
So I really wanted to switch to them, but they don't carry a phone which I really love, which is the Sprint Handspring Trio. Then I don't want to have to throw away my phone to buy a new one because it will cost me hundreds of dollars, and it's detrimental to the environment to throw a phone away. So I sent the FCC Better Business Bureau, my congressman, my story about how frustrated I was. And that's when the FCC emailed me this reply and said, well, actually, a ruling was made that went into effect in November. So I was very surprised to hear that. And I emailed them back when they sent that to me. I said, well, this is worthy of a press release. Why haven't I heard about it on the media?
Now you have. The decision forcing wireless carriers to let you unlock your phone stays in effect until November 2009. We'll link to it from our site at onthemedia.org, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
It was all over the news this week, reported in the New York Times, on CNN, the BBC, and right here on NPR. Shot 4 times in the stomach, chest, and shoulder, Steve Rogers lay bleeding on the steps of the federal courthouse in New York City. The truth of the incident is not yet known, justice is not yet served, and the American way is not yet restored. Captain America is no more. The son of Irish immigrants, Rogers was born in 1917 on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, drank a super serum made by the military, and prevailed during World War II and beyond as Marvel Comics' super soldier. In Volume 1, Issue 1, Captain America, Sentinel of Our Shores, comes face to face with his first nemesis, Adolf Hitler. In the mid-1940s, Cap would defeat a host of villains in a series of black and white movie shorts with titles like Blade of Wrath, Vault of Vengeance, and The Purple Death.
The commissioner's been alibying his failure to turn up anything in these Purple Death murders.
You remember the commissioner and I have cleaned up crime waves in this town before.
Yes, that mysterious Captain America did most of your work for you.
66 years, 5 volumes, and nearly 600 comic books later, Captain America lay dead at the hands of a 40-year-old Marvel Comics writer named Ed Brubaker, who titled the shocking storyline, The Death of the Dream.
When I first bought Captain America, I was living on the military base in Guantanamo Bay as a little kid. My dad was an officer in the Navy, and so for me, Captain America has always been this part of my life connected to the government and the military. And the reason that I titled it The Death of the Dream is because I wanted to do a story that explored what Captain America meant to America. And I found that doing the comic with Cap in it, he's such a large figure, and so much of the comic is about him leaping from rooftops and punching out bad guys, that it's hard to actually address what Captain America stands for. And I felt like with the wake that follows his death, you can actually explore what he means to the country by not having him be here.
And his death was the culmination of a civil war in the superhero universe that was being fought over, largely over civil liberties.
Yeah, it began with a huge disaster where a bunch of school children were killed by some supervillains, and the government basically, in response to it, decided that, you know, the superheroes were part of the problem too, and that they needed to be regulated. So the government enacted this thing called the Superhero Registration Act. Anyone who refused to register and give up their secret identity to the government became a criminal, essentially. And Captain America thought it was anti-American and anti-civil rights. And so his response to it was to lead the resistance. And that became a key conflict between him and Iron Man and several other major characters, and it kind of split the Marvel Universe up the middle with the heroes against each other.
Okay, now, obviously this isn't the real world, but, you know, we've seen in the past few elections a genuine political schism in America that we've shorthanded as the red state, blue state divide. Have you noticed among Captain America fans that some paint him red and others blue?
Oh, completely. The most interesting and frustrating thing sometimes about working on the character is every hardcore right-wing nut wants Cap to be their guy, and every liberal wants Cap to be standing on the street crying out against the Bush administration. Whereas Captain America is a guy who grew up during the Depression and idolized the New Deal and FDR, and I always thought would be a New Deal Democrat. But at the same time, he's a guy who spent his entire adult life in the military. He wouldn't be a red stater or a blue stater. He'd see the shades of gray and purple.
And of course, now you've killed the possibility of consensus with 2 bullets from a sniper. So where does the series Captain America go from here? They killed Superman off and brought him back. Any chance for a resurrection?
One of the things that I really tried to do really hard in Cap 25 was to make sure that his death was an incredibly realistic death. You know, he gets shot by a sniper, and then as the crowd surges around him, he gets taken out by some close-range shots straight to the torso. There's never going to be a comic fan in the world who reads this issue and doesn't think in the back of their mind, he's not really dead. They're going to bring him back someday. And I wanted to try and do as much as I could to just get them thinking, this is a really human death, and, you know, maybe he's not coming back, and I really want to see what happens after this. We're not going to, you know, see a bunch of people putting on Captain America's costume and becoming, you know, Teen Cap and, and various things like that. I think that we're going to try and go a different route and actually just tell a really intriguing story about what Steve Rogers meant to America and what he meant to the people around him.
What Steve Rogers meant to America. If you, Ed, could cast yourself into one of your comics and you were tasked to give his eulogy, what would you say?
Sorry. I always saw Captain America as being much more of a character like Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Paine, someone who really thought about what America was supposed to be as opposed to what America is. And when I was a little kid, they did a story where Cap basically finds out that the president is a bad guy and quits and goes around the country on a motorcycle. So I always liked that about Captain America, that he was sort of a voice for what was good about the American dream. And at the same time, he could be a very strong voice of dissent. His superpowers is that he's given a formula that takes the human body to the ultimate perfection of what the human potential would be. That's how he became Captain America. And I thought, because he's Captain America and not just Captain UN or Captain World, his ideals are what America could be and what America should be as opposed to what America sometimes is.
And that's why you killed him.
I just killed him to tell a good story.
Ed Brubaker is a writer for Marvel Comics. The creator of Captain America, 93-year-old Joe Simon, believes his patriotic super soldier will someday return from the dead. For now, though, he's in mourning. In fact, he's sitting Shiva.
I am. I'm sitting Shiva and trying to keep from crying here.
How did you come up with the idea for Captain America?
Well, at that time, we were always trying to come up with new characters and new ideas and sell a comic book, because there were really tough times at the end of the Depression. And just looking at the competition there, it occurred to me that the villains, not the heroes, were selling more books. So I went about looking for ideas for new villains. And we were not at war at the time, but it was obvious what was going to happen over there in Europe. And Hitler was like a funny guy. He was a clown. And so I thought that we would have a live villain instead of a Penguin or Joker.
And having found your villain in Hitler, you had to create a hero to defeat him.
Exactly, yes. We had enough of the guys with trick powers that flew through the air and, you know, had the spider webs and all that. But to be a real nice American that would walk a lady across the street, that was our goal for Captain America.
Now, in that year when you first wrote Captain America...
Yeah, 1941.
Did you have him defeat Hitler?
No, I don't think we ever got that far. Hitler actually wasn't as sinister in our books as he was stupid. So we weren't going to kill him off. He was doing too well for us.
Now, you said earlier that you're trying to keep from crying.
I'm getting a lot of hits on the internet here of people that are veterans and patriots all over the world. And they're actually taking this thing really to heart. Grown men are crying over it. I just don't understand. Give it a listen.
Joe, thank you very much.
Okay, Brooke.
Joe Simon created Captain America in 1941.
Now I'm calling on citizens from all over the world. This is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees, so will you catch me now? I'm falling.
Falling.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner and Christopher Wirth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keith, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.